Welcome to the Orange County Catholic Radio Show on AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties and on AM 930 in Los Angeles County. Each week, we bring you compelling conversation with church leaders and laity, talking about the things going on in our diocese and discussing the important issues that impact the world around us. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, where Catholic faith is crystal clear. Here now to introduce our guest and today's topic is your host, Rick Howick.
And welcome to Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm Rick Howick, your host. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the background to why we Catholics believe what we believe when it comes to going into the voting booth. Now, if you've been following this program, we spent a couple weeks ago, talking extensively about what the bishops have said from the USCCB on voting your consciences through faithful citizenship is the name of their document. And I had a friend of mine, Daryl Sequeira, the chair of theology at Servite High School, sit down and spend 2 weeks going through that document and talking about why Catholics have these ideas and these moral choices as being paramount of importance, as opposed to what other people might consider to be important. And what came to me in a dinner conversation with my teenage daughters kind of struck me that we need to back up a little bit and talk a little more about why. I was having a wonderful conversation with my daughter. She was reviewing her other 14-year-olds who were talking with her over pizza. And she was explaining to them, as any good Howick daughter would do, about why Catholic faith teaches what it does. And essentially, they were saying to her, well, why don't we just live and let live? Which sounds reasonable enough until you begin to realize that when these 14-year-olds are talking about that, they're basically saying to allow the way society is going in morality, in this concept of who we are and what we want to do, is everything okay as long as I believe it to be okay? That's the direction that they wanted to go. So I put my utensils down on the table and sat up and said, you know, you're right. We need to talk a little bit more about this. And so I sat down and took a look again at some of the stuff that I had been teaching back when I was a high school teacher in morality at Notre Dame High School in Riverside. So for our listening audience, I'm going to warn you ahead of time, you're about to hear a little bit about what Catholic morality is and what the backgrounds to Catholic morality are for going into the voting booth. So with that in mind, I want to talk, therefore, a little bit, not just about why abortion is always wrong and that no, a woman cannot, does not have the right to kill the child inside of her, and why homosexual marriage is never really a marriage, and why transgenderism is not real, and that these are all critical to our laws, not just our preferences. And we're going to talk, therefore, a little bit about why. So let's begin. A long, long time ago in a Vatican far, far away, a pope by the name of John the 23rd announced that he was calling a council, the Second Vatican Council. And literally, some people fell off their chairs at hearing that he was going to do this. Remember, he was supposed to be just an old caretaker pope. And he brought into existence this Second Vatican Council. A little historical background here. The First Vatican Council, which was held in the 19th century, was supposed to talk about three major issues: the papacy, the bishops, and the laity. And they got through the papacy when they had to pack up everything and run because Garibaldi was coming in to invade and the Vatican was losing its territories and they all had to leave town in a hurry. So 90 years later, in calling the Second Vatican Council, what Archbishop Roncalli, now Pope John the 23rd, was doing was actually continuing the unfinished business of what was originally supposed to be taken care of back at that First Vatican Council long, long ago. Now, what had happened in the meantime, though, was all this growth of different concepts and ideas in the late 19th, early 20th century, and a war had essentially developed in theology between what we would call Neo-Thomism, Thomas Aquinas, and the idea that God created things a certain way, and Neo-Hegelianism, which again is another German guy. And it's all about that everything can change, that we have a dialectic. Things go back and forth and change and change and change. And the theologians on the neo-Thomistic side were in conflict with the theologians on the neo-Hegelian side. So Karl Rahner, for example, was a neo-Hegelian who argued for universal salvation. And in this long-talking Vatican Council II, he submitted several documents that were called schemas, along with several other theologians, those who were liberal, those who were conservative, those who were Thomistic, those who were Hegelian. And those schemas is what they were called. Those schemas set forth what their arguments were. Those schemas then were often taken, talked about, and then parts of them were taken out and put into the final documents. So if you look at what Karl Rahner had said about universal salvation and the idea that someone could be an anonymous Christian, not even realize they're Christian, well, parts of that theology was taken into account in the document Lumen Gentium, and was reflected in the idea that if there's no fault of your own, where you could have never heard the gospel and therefore could have never rejected the gospel, it's possible for Christ to have miraculously worked to save you. But that's a far cry from the original schema of Karl Rahner that all people are going to be saved. What ended up happening was that these rejected schemas were all saved by the people in academia in the different universities. And the professors that operate in those universities began to refer to them as the direction in which the Second Vatican Council was going to go. This became known as the so-called spirit of Vatican II. I remember when I was studying canon law at Catholic University of America several years ago, and I was discussing an issue of Catholic theology, and I was really approaching it from a neo-Thomistic perspective, which is essentially the perspective that has won out for the last, roughly 800 years, and in the last 200 years has developed so that in the last 100 years, it's now known as neo-Thomism. And neo-Thomism is the perspective that the Catholic Church has held to moralistically for a long time. I was approaching it that way, and I was told by my professor, go back upstairs, read the schemas, because that is where the Second Vatican Council meant to go. That's what we were all told, the so-called spirit of Vatican II. It was also during that time, during Vatican II, when you had a couple of things happen in the American Catholic Church that changed some things dramatically as well. First, we had a couple of renegade theologians, also from the Washington, D.C. area, Fathers Greeley and Curran, and a few others, begin to meet and talk with Catholic politicians and explain to them that it's possible from their perspective and how they read Hegelian-based morality. Again, that was not what took the day in the Second Vatican Council. But Hegelian-based morality, that the rights of women and their push toward equality with men could outweigh the value of possible human life in the woman. And this became the moral reasoning for why you have so many Catholic politicians who will say that abortion can be okay to vote for, because from their perspective, they see it as the lesser of two evils. Now, this has been totally rejected by their church. It has been totally rejected by the last several popes. Abortion cannot be supported by Catholic theology from that Thomistic perspective especially. But that's how it came into politics and why we still have it today amongst many prominent Catholic politicians who will also hold that abortion is okay to hold to, at least to vote for. And of course, that came from that same renegade period. A second thing happened, and this was documented very well by George Weigel not that long ago in an article that he put out that talked about how in the wake of Humana Vitae, which came out in the late 1960s, 1968, I believe, where you had a number of Catholic professors, again, out of Catholic University of America, rebel and say that they could not support the basic tenets of Humana Vitae. And Cardinal Patrick O'Boyle, who was the cardinal for Washington, D.C. at the time, sanctioned these priests, these professors. And he was eventually, I won't say overturned, but he was told that you need to not sanction them anymore. And what happened with that was it made many bishops back off, according to Weigel. And so for the 1970s, you had a number of theologians throughout the United States and throughout the world who were in these very liberal areas, who were holding to the schemas of Vatican II, but not the documents themselves, who felt that they were free to talk about this version of morality. And so the confusion of the 1970s. What did the Second Vatican Council actually mean? And into this mix walks Karol Wojtyla from Krakow. He was the author of Love and Responsibility, which eventually became known as the Theology of the Body. And when he took on the mantle of being the Pope in 1978, he began to settle, what exactly does Vatican II mean? Well, the Second Vatican Council means exactly this. And he began to write, and he wrote, and he wrote, and he wrote. The reason why we often will refer to St. John Paul as John Paul the Great is because from 1978 on, he immediately began to settle. There is no nebulous spirit of Vatican II. There is the documents, and this is what those documents mean in the Redeemer of Man, in the Gospel of Life, and in what became one of the most important encyclicals of all time, Veritatis Splendor, the Splendor of Truth. These were truly great. When we come back, we will be discussing a little bit about why John Paul and Veritatis Splendor really color today's elections and why it is that it's become so very important for us to understand the background to the morality behind why we vote. And we're back at Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm Rick Howick, and today we're discussing the background to the morality behind why we Catholics are so stuck in the morality that we have. And I think as you hear where we're going, stuck is certainly not the term that we really should be using, because it really is an embrace of the truth of what Christ has given us. So with that in mind, I want to talk a little bit about the concept of objective versus subjective morality. And this goes right back to what John Paul II, St. John Paul, gave us in that perhaps most important of encyclicals that he wrote, Veritatis Splendor, or The Splendor of Truth. That encyclical encapsulates beautifully what has been understood from a Thomas Aquinas' perspective of objective truth. But he does it by framing it with the biblical background to which it belongs. So he begins his discussion by talking about Matthew chapter 19, verse 16, where we have the story of the rich young man. And I'm going to read just a little bit of that to you to get that background so you understand where John Paul was coming from. "And behold, one came up to him, saying, 'Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life?' And he said to him, 'Why do you ask me about what is good? One there is who is good. If you would enter life, keep the commandments.' He said to him, 'Which?' And Jesus said, 'You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself.' The young man said to him, 'All these I have observed. What do I still lack?' Jesus said to him, 'If you would be perfect, go sell what you possess and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me.' When the young man heard this, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions." And then Jesus talked about the story of the camel going through the eye of the needle. And this is when Peter asks him, "Who then can be saved?" But Jesus looked at them and said to them, "With men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible." Now, John Paul then takes this story and uses it as the diving board to dive into this pool of morality. And it starts off by saying, good teacher, what good must I do? And Jesus asks him a question. He doesn't give him a response at the beginning. He says, why do you call me good? There is only one who is good. And of course, this rich young man was learned. He had been trained. He knew essentially and had been trained essentially in what you should be as a good Jew. He knew that there is only one that is good, and that is God. And what Jesus is referring to here is the idea that the moral good is determined by the goodness of God. God alone is good. We cannot change God. We therefore cannot change what is good. And if you wish to be perfect, and that term perfect in Greek is the word teleos. We get the word telescope from that, meaning something at its far distance to reach that distance. It means to reach your proper end. If you would reach your proper end, which God created you to be, then be perfect, be complete, embrace the good, and live that out. Come, follow me. He goes back at a different point, and I won't read you this section. You can look it up. Veritatis Splendor is a very good read. But he talks about the original fall in Genesis and how when they reach their hand out and they're tempted by a tree called the knowledge of good and evil. Now, notice later on they talk about the tree of life. This is not that tree. This is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And they are tempted to take from this tree, which they were told not to do. And they take it anyway, and their eyes are suddenly open, and they understand in their own mind what is good and what is evil. Now, I want to back up for a moment and ask, what could this possibly mean? Why was this so bad? Don't we all get to do this? Well, in a way, yes. And in a way, no. The knowledge or the ability to state what is good and the ability to state what is evil can really only be from God. And notice this, if God has said something is good, and you, in your knowledge, decide it's evil, who's right? By the same token, if God says something is bad, and you, in your wisdom, self-focused, decide, no, this is a good thing, who's right? What John Paul talks about is that what's right is what God wants, and that is not going to change. What is good is determined by God alone, and that God alone, therefore, declares what is good. He also declares what is evil, and that can never change. Now, once we understand that that objective truth, the idea that God is the one who is the author of good, and that to get away from God is to be evil, we then are called by Jesus to follow him. And of course, he is not able to follow him. This is interesting to me because what it says is that we, in our own self-determination, are the ones who want to determine what is good or evil now that we have supposedly taken of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, whereas God is the one who is only authorized to determine. If God is the subject who determines what is good or evil? God says this is good, so God is the subject. If he determines what is good or evil, that is the object that he's determining. God is determining that thing, whether it be adultery or abortion or whatever the moral issue may be, is either good or evil as an objective truth. It is determined by God. Whereas once we decide that we can overrule God, when we make the decision, we become the subject in charge. And we call that subjective morality. And to follow the idea that there are set good and set evil, that's objective morality. Objective morality is Thomistic, or from Thomas Aquinas. Subjective morality is in line with that Hegelianism we talked about a little earlier. So we move forward. John Paul II therefore taught that objective morality cannot change. After all, God says that from everlasting to everlasting, I change not. Therefore, the good or the bad cannot change. I want to read to you something from Crisis Magazine, an article that came out in July 14th, by Kenneth Crowther. I'm going to read you a part of it, but I want you to hear how different the morality of subjectivism has become. And I want you to guard your ears a little bit, because some of this is going to be quite provocative. This is called Secularism as Religious Indoctrination by Kenneth Crowther. Again, Crisis Magazine from July. And part of it, he writes, Australia has a program in its schools that, at first glance, you'd have to be crazy to be against. It's called Safe Schools, and it is an anti-bullying campaign. Well, at least that's how it has been promoted. The program consists of allowing students to wear whatever uniforms they want, encouraging schools to allow bathroom use by any gender, promoting homosexual and transgender role play in the classroom with students as young as 11. And it points children to websites which endorse chest binding and even contained links to websites that were called the Tool Shed, which had to do with purchasing sex toys. And I kid you not. And the article continues, the changes notwithstanding, the anti-bullying campaign is actually resulting in bullying of the children who feel uncomfortable about participating, sometimes even by their teachers. Stories are rolling in from around the nation detailing the explicit nature of what is being taught. One such story is of a heterosexual 13-year-old boy doing some research on his home computer. His homework? To find a picture of a male celebrity on the internet and explain to the entire class why he is sexually attracted to that male. And much of this is about the parents' consent and is not optional. Now, that's just in Australia. And our bathroom gender policy is something that I know we've just had on the scene not long ago. But this, too, has become a very important point. When we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit more about this entire policy, because this case crosses over. But I want to talk to you when we come back about a statement put out by the Archbishop of Oklahoma, Archbishop Paul Coakley, because what he does is take what has been given us in the current administration's bid to force people to use gender-neutral bathrooming and shows why this is becoming not only a program that is designed to change the way that Catholics believe about their morality, but that it is meant to change all of society and coerce everyone into believing this entire same way. We'll be right back.
The Diocese of Orange is excited to announce our new online store. The Orange County Catholic Bookstore has thousands of Catholic product offerings, from prayer cards to crucifixes, statues, and icons. Whether you're searching for that special devotional gift, products, or books that support your personal faith journey, or a beautiful image or statue for your home or business, please visit store.occatholic.com. Proceeds from purchases help to sustain the social outreach, educational, and pastoral ministry of the Diocese of Orange. Imagine five glorious days in Rome, exploring the Vatican without the crowds. Subscribe to the OC Catholic newspaper for just $1 for the year, and you'll be entered to win this exclusive Rome VIP Vatican exploration experience. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to win a trip for two to the Eternal City, flights and accommodations included. Please visit occatholic-subscribe.com to enter, or call 714-282-3045 for more information.
Join the faithful from across Southern California Sunday, September 18th, as we celebrate the dynamic and inspiring journey that began 40 years ago at the founding of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Orange in 1976, with a day of incredible events for the whole family. Start the day with a 5K at 7:30 a.m., an outdoor mass at 9:30 a.m., and the Blowout Music Festival from 3 to 9:30 p.m. Performers include Matt Maher, Jackie Francois, Phil Wickham,
This Is Amazing Grace,
Andy Mineo, Colton Dixon, and Jordan Felix. Bring the kids to experience sledding in September on a real snow hill. Open from 11 a.m. till 2:30 p.m. For tickets and information, visit www.rcbo.org or call 714-282-3045. Don't miss the Diocese of Orange's 40th anniversary celebration. Call 714-282-3045 for more information.
Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm Rick Howick, your host, and we're coming to you from the good offices at Immaculate Heart Radio, coming from the campus in Garden Grove for the Diocese of Orange at Christ Cathedral, high atop the Tower of Hope. And here is where Catholic faith is crystal clear. today we're talking about some of the background to the morality behind why we Catholics believe what we do in going into the voting booth. And we were talking a little bit about objective morality, subjective morality as defined by John Paul II, John Paul the Great, and how in Veritatis Splendor we have this determination by God as to what is good, and therefore it can't change. And if we move away from what God has said is good and go into things that God has clearly not sanctioned, we do that as an evil. And then we were talking, I introduced to you some things that were happening in Australia that really kind of made the hair on the back of my head stand up, and I think probably did yours as well. And with that in mind, I wanted to read to you an article published on the website for the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City by Archbishop Paul Coakley, and it's entitled, "It's About More Than Restrooms." Earlier this year, I came across an all-gender restroom in the airport of a large American city. I had never seen such a thing. I snapped a picture. It struck me as strange, certainly not something I would expect to find in Oklahoma. That may be about to change. The media has been highlighting recent legal attempts in some states to keep boys out of girls' restrooms and vice versa. This latest restroom controversy is a manifestation of the new battleground over gender. This battle, however, is about more than who can use which restroom. According to rules just issued by the Obama administration, public schools ought no longer to differentiate between boys and girls based on their biological sex, but now ought to acknowledge and accept their personal gender identity. This is to be the basis for allowing them to choose which restroom to use. So-called gender identity, according to the gender theorists, is a matter of personal expression rather than biology. Consequently, if a boy self-identifies as a girl, then he ought to be allowed to use the girl's restroom or locker in any school that accepts government funding. It doesn't take long to imagine the bizarre consequences that this way of thinking and establishing public policy and law will have in the future. Efforts to resist the imposition of this gender ideology are already meeting stiff resistance from the federal government and powerful economic forces that are determined to advance their radical reinterpretation of human personhood and relationships. In recent years, many Americans were astounded by how rapidly public opinion, cultural standards, and laws all changed with regard to the acceptance of so-called homosexual marriage. Today, anyone who questions the appropriateness of equating same-sex unions with traditional marriage is labeled a bigot, a homophobe, and a hater. Stiff economic penalties and laws are being enacted that threaten individuals, businesses, and other associations that dissent from this new radical orthodoxy that is being advanced by a powerful network of special interests. What proponents called marriage equality was just the beginning. Gender ideology is the next tsunami that threatens to sweep away centuries of accepted human wisdom about the complementarity and real differences between men and women. These differences are not merely about self-expression and personal choice. Science, philosophy, theology, and the accumulated wisdom of every culture have recognized that these differences are rooted in something real and objective. They are rooted in biology, and more fundamentally, they are rooted in the design of the Creator. Pope Francis's recent apostolic exhortation, The Joy of Love, acknowledges the threat that this new radical gender ideology poses. It was the subject of much discussion in the recent Synod of Bishops on the Family. Pope Francis writes, quote, "Yet another challenge is posed by the various forms of an ideology of gender that denies the difference and reciprocity in nature of a man and a woman and envisages a society without sexual differences, thereby eliminating the anthropological basis of the family. This ideology leads to educational programs and legislative enactments that promote a personal identity and emotional intimacy radically separated from the biological differences between male and female. Consequently, human identity becomes the choice of the individual, one that can also change over time. As with every ideology, this one asserts itself as beyond dispute and absolute. It envisions a brave new world in which the creature asserts himself as the creator of his own reality. This is demonic. Pope Francis continues, quote, "It is one thing to be understanding of human weakness and the complexities of life, and another to accept ideologies that attempt to sunder what are inseparable aspects of reality. Let us not fall into the sin of trying to replace the Creator. We are creatures and not omnipotent. Creation is prior to us and must be received as a gift. At the same time, we are called to protect our humanity. And this means, in the first place, accepting it and respecting it as it was created." Unquote. That's from Amoris Laetitia, number 56. And then the Archbishop continues, "I'm not an alarmist, but it seems clear to me that battle lines are being drawn very clear, and these lines are about more than government overreach. This is a spiritual battle between light and darkness. St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle." And that, again, was Archbishop Paul S. Coakley from May 29th of 2016, and he was talking quite forcefully about why this gender ideology is actually part of a movement to undermine what Catholics actually are able to believe and able to say. This is part of what's at stake, and this is why we were talking about not only what's happening in Australia, but also what's happening here. So we've seen several cases where this idea, you are what you think you are, is being imposed on all of us, contrary to our own belief in an objective reality. Therefore, objective morality was defined by John Paul II and has been echoed by Pope Francis. Now, we see that the Supreme Court has indeed allowed the Hobby Lobby group off the hook for having their consciences being violated by the Affordable Care Act. But that was only one small group. And then, of course, we remember the Little Sisters of the Poor, where they were being compelled to offer artificial birth control and to offer abortifacients in their own policies against their religion. They didn't win their case. People have painted that as a win, but they didn't win their case. The Supreme Court simply sent it back to be reconsidered. The assumption is that they're going to win it by sending it back, but the court did not side that way. And at the last part of last year's session of the Supreme Court, there was a case that the court refused to consider, which means that that case stands as was finally decided, which was against the consciences of the people involved. That was a case based in Olympia, Washington. The Storman family runs their own drugstore, Ralph's Thriftway Drugs in Olympia, Washington. And the law was written in Washington so that they had to fill prescriptions for everything, and that included the morning after pill and other pills that could be considered abortifacients. The morning after pill, because it can interfere with a conceived egg implanting, can result in abortions. And so, under good conscience, the Stormans said that they could not agree to this. And so they lodged a protest with the Supreme Court. Actually, they lodged a protest with their own court. It went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which told them that they did not have any leg to stand on. If they're going to be a pharmacist, they had to be prepared to cooperate with the killing of children. And the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear that case. Now, there were three people who objected to that ruling on the court. They were Samuel Alito, Justice Thomas, and Justice Roberts. And Alito wrote for those three in his opinion, which was, again, the minority opinion. Samuel Alito wrote, "If this is a sign of how religious liberty claims will be treated in the years ahead, those who value religious freedom have cause for great concern. Ralphs has made a strong case that the regulations are improperly designed to stamp out religious objections." And again, this was joined by Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas. But if this is the way things are going, no wonder the Supreme Court has become such an important consideration for when we decide who we're going to vote for and which groups we're going to vote for. Now, in addition to this, by forcing these issues, two things happen. Number one, subjective morality is normalized. So we were talking earlier about the difference between objective morality. That's the morality the Catholic Church has held to consistently for the last 2,000 years. It's been defined well by Thomas Aquinas and the Neo-Thomists. and it has recently encountered this challenge from subjective morality. Subjective morality is what the court wants us to have. Objective morality is what the Catholic Church says is real. And subjective morality is being normalized. While objective, that is Christian morality, is being abnormalized. And we're being called bigots. We're being told that we're intolerant and that we offend others' rights to feel good about themselves. We therefore must be stopped, and we will be stopped. Sanctions against conscience have resulted. We've seen bakers and photographers who have been fined. The sisters are still fighting their fight about abortifacients and contraceptives. Druggists are being told they have to provide abortion drugs, and doctors are being told that they must participate in assisted suicide. When we come back, we're going to continue with a little bit more and then a conclusion as to why it is that the bishops came down so hard on these certain points as to why we Catholics must embrace a very strong set of opinions about what our morality is when we go into the voting booth. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm Rick Howick, your host, and we will be right back. Back at Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm Rick Howick, and we've been talking for the last 45 minutes or so about some background as to why the Catholics, especially as we study the USCCB's pamphlet on faithful citizenship, which we went over with Daryl Sequeira here for 2 weeks straight not that long ago. And I highly recommend that if you have a chance to go back and look up those podcasts, listen to those, because Daryl does a really good job at plumbing what those individual issues are. Today, what we're trying to do is to discuss a little bit why we come out so strongly and what the stakes really are for the Catholic morality behind it. So it's been more of a morality lesson today, but I have a couple more things I still want to say. I hope you'll listen to me for the next 15 minutes or so. There's another article that came out from First Things back in July by Wesley J. Smith. This is from July 22nd. And he was talking about how we have several people who have already faced repercussions because they are holding to their conscience beliefs. And he documents not only the what we talked about before about the pharmacists who are being forced against their consciences to deliver drugs that can kill children in the womb. But he also says, and I'm going to read to you just what he says from this article. He quotes in a suit that is being that was being brought by the ACLU against Catholic hospitals, Directive 45 of the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Services, which is published by the USCCB, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And it states that, and then here's the quote, abortion, that is the direct intended termination of pregnancy before viability or the directly intended destruction of a viable fetus, is never permitted. Every procedure whose sole immediate effect is the termination of pregnancy before viability is an abortion, which, in its moral context, includes the interval between conception and implantation of the embryo. Now, stepping away from the article for a moment, this is why people who are concerned about Plan B as a pharmacist might not want to prescribe that drug. Because that drug, while on the one hand, it will stop a woman from actually producing an egg, on the other hand, if she's already produced an egg, it won't let it implant, and if it's already conceived with the sperm, that's an abortion. And so the law in Washington that is refusing to allow pharmacists to opt out of that on conscience is now being brought to bear in a different set of laws through the ACLU and through other groups in order to try to force a similar type of thing on other agencies, in this case, on Catholic hospitals. A suit that sought to prevent Trinity Health Corporation from obeying the ethical and religious directives was dismissed earlier this year. The dismissal was based on a procedural issue and prevented a principled ruling based on the First Amendment rights. So what this article is saying is they're going to bring this up again. And then a similar case was recently filed in California after administrators of Mercy Medical Center, a Catholic hospital operated by Dignity Health, refused to permit a requested sterilization because of Catholic moral teaching that such a procedure is, quote, intrinsically immoral, unquote. That, of course, stepping away from the article, that, of course, comes directly out of Veritatis Splendor, comes out of John Paul the Great, comes out of what we have always believed to be true, that there are certain things that are intrinsically evil, and we cannot participate in those. So back to what the article was saying. Indicating the anti-religious liberty bias in healthcare, the California Medical Association has joined the ACLU in trying to force the hospital to violate Catholic teaching. And then it goes on to say, the state of California, in a major hit to free speech, recently passed a law requiring such pro-life centers to advertise where abortion information could be obtained. So if you are a pro-life counseling center, you have to provide the following statement for everyone to see in your pro-life counseling setting. Here's the quote. California has public programs that provide immediate, free, and low-cost access to comprehensive family planning services, including all FDA-approved methods of contraception, prenatal care, and abortion for eligible women. To determine whether you qualify, contact the county social services offices at, and then you insert the telephone number there. Now, this is required in California now of all abortion counseling services. But of course, a similar statement about where you can find abortion counseling services is not required at any Planned Parenthood. So we're seeing already not only bakers and photographers and the sisters and the druggists and the doctors, we're seeing Catholic hospitals and whole groups of people being persecuted for their religious freedom. And it's all in the name of groups in our society, of which, frankly, they're a minority, but they are a very vocal minority, who are pushing this agenda of selfism or of subjective morality. And they're doing it in ways that are trying to stigmatize those of us who say, no, objective morality is what we believe to be true. That's what came to us from God. And we believe that it is a violation of our faith to practice anything other. Religious freedom is therefore already threatened. And Christian persecution is therefore a major voting concern. Recently, California faced yet another assault on religious freedom. Assembly Bill 1146 by Assemblyman Lara was proposed, of which Archbishop Gomez came out against. And I want to read to you a little bit about what Archbishop Gomez said about that, because this particular bill would have been a huge hit against Catholic education at the university level. So I'm going to read to you from an article that was taken from Crux Now, and it contains in it Archbishop Gomez's statement along with Bishop Charles E. Blake. So part of that article reads, current California law exempts religious schools from non-discrimination laws in cases where applying them violates their beliefs. A new bill on higher education, however, would force faith-based institutions to choose between compromising their deeply held beliefs or risking an endless wave of costly litigation. And so here's what Archbishop Gomez says about it. He says, this week, the California Assembly begins final deliberations on Senator Ricardo Lara's Equity in Higher Education Act, SB 1146. The bill, which passed the Senate in late May, has a salutary purpose to ensure against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation at California campuses. Unfortunately, this legislation goes far beyond that. As it is written today, SB 1146 would violate the religious freedom of faith-based colleges and could jeopardize higher education opportunities for tens of thousands of Californians they serve, including many who are Black, Latino, Asian, and low-income. Here is the problem as we see it. Current California law exempts religious schools from non-discrimination laws in cases where applying these laws would not be consistent with the religious tenets of that organization. And I want to step away from what Archbishop Gomez said. In other words, If we in our institutions of higher learning, our Catholic institutions, if we determine based on what Veritatis Splendor has taught us, based on what Pope Francis has told us, that certain things are intrinsically evil and certain things should not be done, we are exempt from following laws that violate those in under today's law. But SB 1146 would have forced us to comply with those laws, regardless of whether or not that meant which bathrooms people use or which dormitories people sleep in at these religious institutions. So continuing with Archbishop Gomez's statement, SB 1146 proposes to drastically narrow that historic exemption so that it would only protect seminaries or other schools that train clergy and ministers. Any other faith-based school that receives state monies or enrolls students who depend on the Cal Grants financial aid program would be forced to change their policies to accommodate practices that in some cases would be contrary to their beliefs and teachings. Detailed provisions in the legislation include rules for bathroom use and sleeping arrangements in dormitories. The bill even has the government setting guidelines for what religious practices and rules for moral conduct will be acceptable on these campuses. If passed as written today, this bill would force faith-based institutions to choose between compromising their deeply held beliefs or risking an endless wave of costly litigation to defend themselves. Now, that was what Archbishop Gomez wrote about a week ago. And in addition to our broadcast and then several other broadcasts and stories that were written, Assemblyman Lara decided to pull the bill as is, and a few days ago recrafted the bill and is going to be resubmitting it so that that section that would have taken away those exemptions will be taken out of the bill. But Assemblyman Lara also made it clear that he does intend to revisit it later and perhaps put it back into new legislation, but he wants to get this through first. Now, why would I talk about a bill, recent as it is, that is currently no longer a threat? Because the threat doesn't go away with that bill. And this is why I wanted to talk this week a little bit about the background. When my daughter was talking to me at the dinner table and she was saying her friends just don't understand. Well, that's because our society has been in the process of being forced in a move away from objective reality and objective morality to the subjective morality. And it's profound. Catholics, therefore, when they're looking at all the issues that are being brought forth by the bishops, whether it's human life, promoting peace, marriage and family life, religious freedom, preferential option for the poor, health care, migration, Catholic education, even care for their common home and global solidarity, all of those come back down to, do we approach them from the perspective of objective morality, or do we succumb to this new tyranny of subjective morality? That's what's behind the document by the USCCB for faithful citizenship. And I thought it was a good conversation with my daughter. I hope it's been a good conversation for you. So thank you for spending this hour with me. It has been a different Orange County Catholic Radio. Normally we would have a conversation. This time I wanted to give a little background. Being a former teacher of morality, it's the risk that we take. So I hope to see you all again next week. You've been listening again to Orange County Catholic Radio, coming to you from the beautiful offices here in Christ Cathedral, high atop the Tower of Hope, and we'll see you again next week.